This is while the Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggression against Syria, targeting more areas in a bid to expand its occupation of the Arab country. The regime's latest attacks targeted areas around the coastal city of Latakia in western Syria. Regime warplanes also fired missiles at a military base on the northern suburbs of Homs in central Syria. Fresh Israeli attacks also struck the Saida Zainab district in the southern suburbs of the capital, Damascus. According to Syrian sources, the Israeli forces have entered the village of Al-Mahriya in the southwestern countryside of Dara and are trying to take control of four villages in the area. Based on the latest data, Israel's occupied over 370 square kilometers of Syrian territory. The Israeli media's claim regime forces are conducting a massive preparation to stay in Syria for a long time, including in Mount Hermon. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman once again calls for international action to deal with ongoing Israeli aggression against Syria. Ismail Baghi, in his weekly presser, condemned Israeli seizure of more Syrian territory. He referred regime's invasion of a buffer zone near the occupied Golan Heights and continued advances into Syrian villages. Baghi also expressed hope for a peaceful transition of the government in Damascus. While responding to a question regarding the reopening of the Iranian embassy in Syria, the spokesman said the diplomatic mission will resume its activities as soon as the necessary conditions are met, which will provide security for the personnel. Now, Baghi also said Iranian presence in Syria was to fight terrorism and to prevent it from a spillover into the region. The spokesman said future of Syria should be decided by Syrians and that regional countries must help in the process. More civilians, including women and children, are killed in Gaza as the Israeli entity continues to pound the besieged territory with air and heavy artillery strikes. 10 Palestinians were killed in attacks on the Daraj neighborhood in central Gaza, while 15 were killed, including two women, in another strike on Gaza City. Israeli warplanes also targeted the southern city of Khan Yunis, resulting in casualties there. An earlier raid on the Shati and Nusayra refugee camps also claimed several lives, including a young girl. Meanwhile, Palestinian Ministry of Education has announced nearly 12,800 students have been killed and almost 21,000 injured, both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, over the past year. And since the onset of Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza in October of last year, over 45,000 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 107,000 injured. The World Health Organization has raised the alarm about the situation of hospitals in northern Gaza amid Israel's unrelenting strikes, describing their conditions as appalling. The WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the comments after a humanitarian team finally reached northern Gaza's only functioning hospitals. Tedros warned Israel's relentless strikes on hospitals has left them without specialized personnel for surgical and maternal care. He added attacks have resulted in further damage to the hospitals and their oxygen and electricity supplies. And calling for an immediate Gaza ceasefire, the WHO chief urged for the protection of health care in the blockaded territory. The agency also announced its efforts to deliver desperately needed supplies have been repeatedly hampered amid Israel's onslaught. According to Palestinian officials, hospitals and healthcare facilities have been among Israel's main targets during the regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza. Families of Israeli captives held in Gaza have held a new rally demanding a ceasefire deal with Palestinian resistance group Hamas. The protesters gathered at the headquarters of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party in Tel Aviv. They insisted a truce between the Israeli regime and Hamas would help secure the release of captives. Protesters blocked a street in central Tel Aviv and chanted anti-regime slogans. Over 100 captives are held in Gaza. Around half of them are believed to be still alive. The families of the captives, backed by other Israelis, have held numerous rallies to press their demands. They accused Netanyahu of deliberately avoiding a deal and prolonging the war so he could remain in power. Yemeni media has reported the U.S. has carried out another act of aggression against the country, hitting the capital Sana'a with a fresh airstrike. According to Yemeni sources, the U.S. aggression targeted the Al-Ardi complex in the capital of Sana'a's Al-Safiya district. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM has assumed responsibility, claiming strike targeted a command and control facility used by Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement for coordinating operations against U.S. naval warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. The strike comes after a high-ranking Ansarullah member warned the U.S. against escalation of tensions, saying that Washington will open up the gates of hell on itself if there's an upsurge in its aggression. Iran's also condemned the aggression against Yemen by the U.S. and U.K. as blatant violation of international law and the United Nations Charter. Our Sana correspondent Yusuf Mari says the U.S. has fabricated a story about attacking the command and control facility operated by Yemen's Ansarullah movement.
Really, the U.S., Israel, and all of the countries that have attacked Yemen because of Yemen's stance with Palestine over the past year or so, they've only targeted old buildings that have already been evacuated, which is why there's no casualties. Nothing significant was really damaged. It's more of just a publicity stunt the Yemeni government feels by the U.S. The U.S. is trying to exercise and flex its muscle by carrying out these attacks and blatantly lying that they attacked a control command center, a military command center operated by the Ansarullah movement. This is just not true. There are no casualties. There are no significant intelligence, military equipment in these facilities. So it's just a way for the U.S. to maintain its hegemonic illusion in the region and to show the world that they're still able to operate anywhere that they want in countries that are adverse to spreading the U.S. and Israeli interest in the region. These attacks against U.S. warships have continued on a weekly basis. Every week we see 2 to 3 operations targeting U.S. interests, targeting U.S. warships, targeting deep into the Israeli regime's occupation, the heart of the occupation in Tel Aviv. They've targeted the port of Haifa. They've targeted the port of Eilat over the past weeks. And this will continue to be the case because, as I mentioned, Yemen's military forces and armed forces, they continue to advance.
A senior Russian general has been killed in an explosion in Moscow. According to an investigative committee, chief of Russia's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection troops, Lieutenant General Igor Kirillov was killed after a bomb hidden in an electric scooter went off outside an apartment complex. An incident took place southeast of the Kremlin. On Monday, the Ukrainian prosecutors charged Kirillov in absentia with the alleged use of banned chemical weapons in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. Russia, however, has denied the allegations. Meanwhile, the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has criticized Joe Biden's decision to allow Ukraine to use American long-range missiles to strike deep into Russian territory, calling the move stupid. Now, Trump hinted he may reverse the decision upon taking office. Criticism highlights Trump's foreign policy agenda with regard to Ukraine, as he has pledged to swiftly end the conflict. Meanwhile, the White House reacted to Trump's remarks, saying the decision was made after months of deliberation, starting before the presidential race. Russia has long been denouncing the U.S. and some Western countries for their military aid to Ukraine. Moscow says arming Kiev will only prolong the conflict. And now several people have been killed in yet another shooting in the United States, this time in the state of Wisconsin.
3 people who have lost their lives. 2 of those people were persons who were pronounced dead at the scene, and 1 while on the way to the hospital. Of the 6 injured and taken to local hospitals, 2 students remain in critical condition. Their injuries are life-threatening. A teacher and 3 other students were taken to area hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. 2 of those victims, 2 of those survivors, have been released from the hospital.
According to police, a teacher and teenage student were killed and 6 others injured at a school in the city of Madison. A 15-year-old female student armed with a handgun has been identified as a shooter, but she was also found dead after officers entered the campus. Police say they are still searching for a motive behind her attack and what caused her death. Now, the gun violence is common in the United States amid heightened debate, pitting gun control advocates against people supporting a right to bear arms. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 385 mass shootings across the U.S. so far this year. Now, magnitude 7.4 earthquake has rocked the Pacific island nation of Vanuatu, damaging buildings and homes in the capital, Port Vila. According to the United States Geological Survey, quake was at a depth of 10 kilometers, with its epicenter being an area off of Port Vila. Tremor is said to be the biggest in 20 years and caused damage to a building hosting foreign missions. including the U.S., British, French, and New Zealand embassies. Footage shows building was partially collapsed with debris strewn around the complex, prompting closure of the American embassy. Earthquake also briefly triggered a tsunami alert for parts of the Pacific Island nation. And now we're to the UK, where activists have held a conference to highlight the British authorities' attempts to crack down on pro-Palestinian activism. Talks particularly focus on the misuse of counter-terrorism laws and the prosecution of individuals and groups like Palestine Action. Issa Kadimi has your story.
As the Israeli genocide against the people of Palestine continues, several groups and individuals have taken direct action against the Israeli war machine in the UK. In August of this year, for example, dozens of activists from Palestine Action stormed the Bristol-based plant belonging to Elbit Systems, the largest weapons manufacturer in Israel, causing an estimated £1 million worth of damage and reportedly resulting in major disruption to some of the most sensitive elements of the factory for months to come. In total, 21 people have since been arrested in relation to the factory raid, many of them under draconian UK anti-terrorism laws, sparking condemnation from human rights groups and observers across the world. As a result, the pro-Palestinian groups have held a meeting under heavy security in the western English city of Bristol to discuss the British government's legal warfare strategy.
Campaigners argue that the British government's use of anti-terrorism legislation is not only intended to punish those disrupting the Israeli war machine, but also to discourage others from taking action against Israeli companies like Elbit Systems and others drenched in Palestinian and Lebanese blood.
Professor David Miller is one of the foremost anti-Zionist academics in the UK. He has been targeted by pro-Israel lobby groups that led to his dismissal from the University of Bristol, an injustice he successfully challenged in court.
They're trying to use any means that they can to attack the pro-Palestine movement. They're using hate crime legislation, and they started to use terrorism legislation. Yes, criminal damage, but they're also using the terrorism legislation against journalists and saying that some journalists have been supporting proscribed organisations, which is plainly ridiculous, but they are using the terrorism legislation, the Terrorism Act of 2000, the Terrorism Act of 2006, in order to suppress the Palestine movement. They can't find any other way of doing it but than using legislation which is plainly inappropriate.
For Professor Miller, the pro-Palestine movement is growing in the UK, and attempts to crush them will not be successful.
It's an intimidation tactic. What they're hoping to do is to convict some people of the Terrorism Act and say, look, this is what awaits you if you take up a placard, a slogan, if you try and invade an arms factory, you will be put into jail. And they want to destroy the pro-Palestine movement. And of course, they're not going to succeed. I mean, the outrage about the genocide is far too deeply entrenched in the UK amongst public opinion. Most young people in this country now believe that Israel has no right to exist. And that's a complete sea change from a year ago.
Britain's culpability in the historic and ongoing crimes of the Israeli regime means that many among the UK public feel duty-bound to continue disrupting and struggling against the Israeli killing machine's tentacles in Britain and beyond. Issa Kadhimi, Bristol, UK.
That's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the Besiege. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah during Besiege Week on November 25th, 2024. When you want to nationalize the oil of your own country, which is controlled by the British, their elements within the country make speeches and write, "What are you saying? How could Iranians manage the Abadan refinery? Iranians cannot even build a clay ewer." That is how they humiliate nations. The besiege is opposed to this. The besiege is opposed to this national humiliation. The dominators manipulate national beliefs in order to be able to dominate nations. Each nation has its own history, its own beliefs, its own great personages, and its own values. They manipulate, destroy, and belittle these. My dear ones, my brothers, sisters, and children, Iran was humiliated for many years, especially during the Qajar and Pahlavi eras. The revolution came and turned things around. After World War I, a conference was held in Paris in which many countries participated in order to make decisions about the situation of the world. The participants were those who were involved in or had been hurt by the war. Iran was among those who had been hurt by World War I, and it sent a delegation. However, the Iranian delegation was denied entry to the Paris conference. This is how they humiliated nations. The Iranian nation was humiliated like this for some period of time. The besieging mindset breaks this barrier. This very dangerous weapon of soft power is neutralized by the besieging mindset.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The besieging mindset brings belief in oneself and gives a teenager and a young person a sense of being on the scene and capable. This was about belief in oneself, and I previously spoke about belief in God. A besiegee knows that everything that exists is God's army. To Allah belong the enemies of the heavens and the earth. Holy Quran, chapter 48, verse 4. And if they move forward on the path of God, this army will come to their help. It is the same today, and it will be the same tomorrow. Without a doubt, this besieging spirit, this potential in the besiege, and the way that the besiege is in our country, and fortunately in several other countries among the members of the resistance front, will definitely prevail over all policies of the US, the West, global arrogance, and the Zionist regime.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've
Re'im occupied Palestinian territories near the Gaza border Saturday, October 7, 2023, at 6:30 a.m. local time. Re'im is a kibbutz in occupied territories A kibbutz is a land that has been occupied by Jewish settlers for agricultural purposes.
Our dream and ideal was to build a kibbutz somewhere in Israel.
Reim Kibbutz was established in 1949, 1 year after the establishment of the occupying Israeli regime. Those who built and settled in the Reim Kibbutz belonged to the Federation of Israeli Scouts. This group was formed in 1919 to create terrorist groups aimed at expelling Palestinians from their ancestral lands.
When I was young, 14 to 15, 16, I was in the underground.
You mentioned volunteering for the Junior Haganah.
Haganah.
Yeah.
Almost everybody was in the underground.
Those who built and settled in the Reim Kibbutz were members of a Zionist terrorist group called the Haganah before the occupation of Palestine.
The Haganah's aims were to establish a Jewish state.
A group whose goal was to use terror and bombings to expel Palestinians.
And as I told you, we were trained, I trained personally, to hit the target. We didn't shoot in the air. Every shot was supposed to hit the target.
The descendants of these occupiers, now living as citizens of a fake country called Israel, continued their ancestors' mission by serving as reserve forces in the occupying army during the times of war. That morning, however, the occupiers faced a different reality. From the sky and ground, Palestinian resistance forces emerged from Gaza. In the blink of an eye, the military base stationed in the Reim Kibbutz was suddenly taken over by Palestinian fighters. The world saw a different picture, in Israel in defeat and Palestinians capturing the enemy in a victorious operation. The Zionists, enraged by this event, declared they will transform the region. Indeed, after this operation, the region was never the same again. The year 1919, the year when the Jewish Scouts organization, the Haganah, the founders of the kibbutz near the Gaza border, was established, was the final year of the First World War.
During the First World War, there was a particularly intense set of negotiations and discussions between the major imperial powers, between the French, the Russians, and the British in particular, cutting in the Italians as well, about what would they do when the war was over and when the Ottoman Empire broke up.
The Ottoman Empire had just fallen, and the Arab territories it controlled were administered by two European powers, namely Britain and France. The land of Palestine, referred to as the State of Palestine, was under British administration. At the time, there was no such thing as Israel, and even the British referred to this land as Palestine and its inhabitants as Palestinians.
It seemed absurd that 600 to 700,000 should give up their land, their homes, their villages, their towns, and hand them over to a minority which was dispersed throughout Palestine. And Palestine, after all, is named after its people, who are the Palestinians.
Old coins from this period also indicate the same name of this land was Palestine. However, British policy was to allow massive immigration of white European Jews into Palestinian territory.
But with the end of the war, into Palestine ports came ship after ship crammed with illegal immigrants.
These immigrants came from Eastern Europe with only one goal in mind, to expel the Palestinians and take their homes and land.
This is the wet dream of Zionism, to see Palestine without Palestinians.
At the same time, the British promise Zionist capitalists that they will be allowed to establish a Jewish state within Palestinian territory.
Palestinians were never consulted about these things, and again, it's to do with the overall strategy, promoting the idea of a Jewish national home.
In the year 1947, just 1 year before the establishment of the Zionist regime, only 7% of the entire land of Palestine was owned by Jews.
There was a strong local culture and so on and so forth, but everything was dominated by the politically challenging situation of the British who conquered the country and promised to turn it into a national home for another people.
The famous myth that the Zionists later spread started from here. This myth claims that Jews bought Palestine from the Palestinians.
Each of this myth does not allow us to understand the real nature of Zionism, the project of Zionism.
The Zionists gathered for the first time in 1897, the first year of Muzaffar al-Din Shah Qajar's reign in the city of Basel, Switzerland, and held a congress called the First Zionist Congress. The goal was to establish a country for the Jews.
In 1897, he formed the World Zionist Organization. And then the First Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland was held.
At this Congress, a Zionist rabbi and mathematician named Hermann Shapira from Lithuania proposed the establishment of a fund to purchase land in Palestine. Jonas Lewinson, an electrical engineer from Ukraine, took on the leadership of the fund. The first money was provided by a Russian Zionist capitalist named Isaac Goldberg, who bought an olive farm in Palestine and gave it to this Zionist foundation, which was named the Jewish National Fund.
When the Jewish National Fund was established in 1901, the idea was that it will help to recruit money in order to purchase land in Palestine for colonization.
In 1924, alongside this foundation, another Zionist organization was established to purchase land in Palestine. The organization was called the Jewish Colonial Trust in Palestine. The name was quite telling. They considered themselves colonizers, European colonizers who had come to take the Holy Land of Palestine, claimed by European crusaders, that is, Jewish and Christian zealots, from the Muslims.
In 1899, they created the Jewish Colonial Trust. This was the first bank established, and from its name, Colonial Trust. So the whole issue of colonizing Palestine was in mind. So it's not a matter of returning to a homeland or to the promised land, but rather creating a Zionist settler colony in the land.
The Jewish Colonization Association in Palestine was founded by a German Zionist capitalist named Maurice de Hirsch. Before this association, he had established another association called the Jewish Colonial Trust, which aimed to implement Jewish colonization in South America, in particular in Argentina. This plan was also proposed at the First Zionist Congress, but ultimately failed. After this, Palestine was proposed as a new target for the modern European colonizers.
These people saw the world as an imperial world.
When the name of Palestine was mentioned, the Rothschild family also appeared. The Rothschild family was a Jewish family that had been engaged in money exchange and banking in German-speaking European lands for three centuries. This family gradually divided into four branches: English, French,
Austrian, and Italian. All these branches were Zionists and supporters of the occupation of Palestine for the benefit of Jews. The Rothschilds spent 15 million French francs to buy land in Palestine. The English branch also negotiated with the British colonial regime and managed to get a promise from the British Foreign Minister, Lord Balfour, to establish a Jewish state in Palestinian lands. But the total land purchased by the two Zionist organizations, the Jewish National Fund and the Jewish Colonial Trust in Palestine, barely reached 6% of the entire land of Palestine. Other Zionists also bought land, which at the same time of the establishment of the occupying regime was slightly more than just 7% of the total land of Palestine. But what about the population? How many Zionists had come from Europe to Palestine?
Who were the Jews in 1948 in Palestine? They were one-third of the population. The vast majority of them arrived 3 years earlier. 3 years earlier.
On September 2nd, 1947, a year before the establishment of the occupying regime, the United Nations Security Council published a report stating that the country of Palestine had a population of 725,000 people, of which only 1% was Jews. The Jewish state would also have a population in which 45%, nearly half, would be Palestinians. This meant that the Jewish population at that time was one-fourth that of the Palestinians. This report clearly showed that both in land ownership and in population superiority, the absolute majority belonged to the Palestinians. However, when the United Nations proposed the partition plan for Palestine, it granted 62% of the total land of Palestine to the Zionists.
The Zionist movement gave the United Nations, when they started their deliberations, they gave them a map. And in the map, they offered that the Jewish state would be 80% of Palestine, which is Israel today without the West Bank. Very interesting. The United Nations thought it was too much to give the one-third of the population, most of them immigrants who came a few years before, to give them 80% was a bit too, even they thought it was a bit too much, so they offered them half of the, more or less half of the country.
This shows that the establishment of a Jewish state has nothing to do with the social realities of those lands, and that a political will from the West is behind this migration. At the same time, the Zionists, along with the terrorist group, the Haganah, attacked Palestinian villages, killing men, women, and children, so that Palestinians who had not sold their homes would abandon them out of fear of Zionist attacks and flee.
It does say in the end of every audit, says basically what to do with the population after you occupy the village of the neighbor is up to you.
The Zionists established three armed terrorist groups with full military capabilities for assassination: Irgun, Lehi, and the Haganah. This is the same group to which the founders of the Kibbutz Re'im near Gaza belonged.
There were three Jewish underground militias. There was a mainstream militia, which was the Haganah, which was about 90% of the country, that is, represented 90% of the population. And there were two smaller, very small militias called the IZL and the LHI, which represented about 10% of the population.
These three groups, in the same year of the establishment of the Zionist entity, attacked the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin and massacred 107 Palestinian villagers.
The Haganah did most of the conquering and most of the warfare. The IZL and LHI, the two dissident, as they were called, militias representing the right, which was very small at the time. Today they rule Israel, but at the time they were very small in Israeli population. They had an important impact on the departure of Arabs because they conquered a village together on the 9th of April 1948 called Deir Yassin, just outside of Jerusalem. And in that village, while conquering it, they killed civilians, and it was subsequently called a massacre. They killed about 100 civilians there.
These groups had a popular model for their methods. Mussolini, the dictator of Italy and founder of European fascism, a close friend of Hitler and the Nazis, opened a training school for Zionist terrorists at the Italian Navy Commando School in 1934. In 1936, the leader of Italy personally visited the school. Zionist terrorist groups needed fascist training for increased violence against the native Palestinians, and for this reason, they modeled their activities after Mussolini. In return, to gain his support, they occasionally attacked British interests who were Italy's enemies. Meanwhile, another group of Zionists was buying the support of British politicians with the vast sums of money from Zionist Jewish bankers. In 1936, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. Ethiopia was the only African country that had never been colonized by any foreign power throughout its history. The Italian fascists aspired to have as many colonies in Africa as the British and French. Therefore, they chose Ethiopia, the only remaining piece of Africa.
All Rome turned out for the announcement of the Italian victory in Ethiopia. They came to read it in papers and shout and cheer about it and hear it shouted by Signor Mussolini.
Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia and the fascist occupation in Italy had such an impact on the Zionists that Zeev Jabotinsky, leader of the Irgun terrorist group and a Zionist theorist, wrote in a letter to a friend, "The administration of Palestine should be entrusted to a country that applies stricter measures against the Arabs. This country could be Italy." The Zionists were not satisfied with the British method of subtly oppressing the native Palestinians and wanted a more decisive and violent approach, like Italy's invasion of Ethiopia. In 1935, the Palestinians suddenly discovered a secret. European Jews living in Palestine were smuggling weapons into Palestine, hidden within cement shipments from Belgium. Further investigations revealed these weapons belonged to Haganah. Upon hearing the news, Sheikh Izzaddin al-Qassam, a Palestinian cleric, rose up in rebellion. But British forces martyred him to show they could support the Zionists as much as the Italian fascists. All European governments needed good relations with Zionist bankers.
The Zionists were working hard to ensure that the terms of the Balfour Declaration would be incorporated into the terms of the mandate itself.
With this support, Zionist terrorists expanded their military operations against the Palestinians. In 1937, they massacred 13 native Palestinians in one operation and then 10 more in another. In the summer of 1938, Palestinians faced relentless bombings by Zionist terrorist groups.
The Jewish terrorist organization, Irgun Zvi Leumi, openly admitted responsibility for the bombing.
In 1948, the Zionist terrorist groups established an organization known as the Israel Offense Forces, the IOF, with the establishment of the occupying regime. This is a very occupying Zionist army that remains in place to this day. This is why the Israeli regime is recognized as a colonial, fascist, and terrorist regime. These three elements were woven into the fabric of the founders of Israel and have now become part of what we know as the occupying Zionist army. An army that is considered an official army by Western countries. However, the foundation of its formation involved several Zionist terrorist groups. The formation of this army in 1948, simultaneously with the establishment of the regime, marked the beginning of a new era of organized regime terrorism. With the establishment of the occupying regime, the newly established regime's army, whose members were previously part of terrorist groups, attacked Palestinian villages. Between 400 and 600 Palestinian villages were destroyed. The horrific news of the attacks spread throughout Palestine. Arab countries declared war on the occupying regime. 100,000 Palestinians fled from villages that were the next targets of the Zionist terrorists. Nearly 200,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes.
But there was a very definite aim of getting rid of as many Palestinians as possible.
Right.
And if you look at the outcome, regardless of the intentions, the outcome is that 750,000 Palestinians became refugees,
yeah,
and the name Palestine was wiped off the map.
The day of the establishment of Israel was such a dark day for the native Palestinians that it has since been called Nakba Day, Arabic for catastrophe, the catastrophe of foreigners claiming ownership of others' lands and driving them out of their ancestral homes. The official date of the declaration of the Jewish state was May 14, 1948. The next day, Arab armies entered the war with the occupying regime to save the Palestinians. The war continued until March 10, 1949. The armies of the Arab countries of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen participated in the war. However, all these armies failed against the Zionists, who had strong support from the United States and Europe. A few hours after the start of the war, Harry Truman, then President of the United States, recognized the Zionist regime. This was while the United Nations had not yet recognized the establishment of the Zionist regime. The U.S. immediately proposed a resolution in the Security Council to urge Arab armies to end the war. Financial and military aid to Israel also continued with full force.
The Jewish forces in 1947-48, I mean, they were far stronger, even far more numerous, actually, than the combined Arab armies.
With the defeat of the Arab armies, the occupying regime now controlled 78% of Palestinian land. The native inhabitants of Palestine now only held 22% of their homeland, the Gaza Strip, and a small part of the eastern shore of the Jordan River, including East Al-Quds.
That was the thinking behind the Zionist movement. Gradual, the building of a Jewish state, and then the gradual expansion of the borders.
A few years later, in 1967, during the Six-Day War, the Zionist entity occupied more parts of Palestinian land, including the city of Al-Quds. In addition to Palestinian land, parts of southern Lebanon and the Golan Heights in Syria were also occupied by the Zionist regime. 2 decades after the establishment of the occupying entity, the dream of liberating Palestinian land and returning the native people to their ancestral homes was fading more and more by the day.
People know that the Palestinians are not coming back because of Israeli power, not because of problems with international law or because there was a deal with the Arab world. No, the only reason the right of return is not implemented is because Israel is powerful enough to prevent it.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum, so welcome. Today we have another interesting story on Lantern, this program. So we go for this story. The Practicing Ones and Paradise. Imam Baqir alayhi salam once related, "Once when my father was seated in the company of his companions addressing them, he said, 'Which of you is willing to hold flaming fire in his hand till the flames die out?' All those present, as if to express their inability, lowered their heads and remained silent. I said, 'Dear father, do you permit me to do it?' He said, 'No, dear son, you are from me and I am from you. It is these people whom I was addressing.' After this, he repeated his request three times. But when no one spoke up, he said, 'How numerous are those who talk, and how few are those who act. I only wanted to have you tested.' Imam Baqir said, 'By Allah, at that moment I observed that they were overcome with such embarrassment that it appeared as if the earth was pulling them towards itself. Perspiration flowed from the foreheads of some, but they did not raise their lowered eyes. When my father observed, he said to them, "May God forgive you. I did not intend anything except goodness. Paradise has many ranks, one of which pertains to none but those who practice and act." Imam Baqir said after these words for my father, "When I looked at them, they seemed to have calmed down and appeared as if they have been relieved of a heavy and weighty burden."
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRB English Radio. Well, in this program, what we do is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about them and explain about some of the points that could be useful for us to make use of them in our daily lives as Muslims. Well, our subject for today's episode is about being practical in religion and not just talking or even boasting about good conducts. You know, Islam means complete submission to the will of Allah. It is the religion prescribed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is a practical religion. Its teachings encompass the whole gamut of human life. All our acts should be to seek the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and accordingly maintaining peace must be our ultimate responsibility. In Islam, purpose of worship is quite wide. Every act performed with pure intention is called ibadah or worship. If one's intention is not pure, his deed cannot be termed as worship. We may recall Holy Prophet's admonition regarding intention. The Holy Prophet ﷺ said to people who had left their homes and migrated to Medina, "Each person will get the reward of his intention. Whose migration is for Allah and His Messenger, his reward is with Allah. As for him whose migration is for the world or for a woman to marry her, his migration is for what he intended." Therefore, every action which is done to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in obedience to His command is ibadah or worship. Verily, the reward of actions depend upon intentions. So, you see, it is evident from this hadith that we should start performing every act sincerely and with good intention. We should not expect cheap publicity or praise from others. Now let's go for a short break and we will be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRIB English Radio. And we are talking about being practical in Islam and not just preach or use words to describe our goodness. Well, it should be kept in mind that Islam is a just and moderate and balanced religion. There were companions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam who, under the influence of Christian monks or on account of their desire to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, had adopted celibacy, an austere way of life, depriving themselves of worldly comforts and luxuries. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam dissuaded them from this act, saying, "This is not the Sharia with which I have been sent." Someone among the companions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "I will not marry women." Some among them said, "I will not eat meat." And some among them said, "I will not lie down in bed." The Holy Prophet ﷺ praised Allah and glorified him and said, "What has happened to those people that they say so and so, whereas I observe prayer and sleep too? I observe fast and suspend observing them. I marry women also. And he who turns away from my sunnah, he has no relation with me." We should learn that in order to attain moral and spiritual perfection, the Muslim's head and heart must be disciplined under the strain and stress of worldly life. Muslims must meet one another. They do meet in mosques 5 times a day. No one can learn the art of wrestling and can become a perfect wrestler without practicing with other wrestlers. Likewise, no human being can learn the art of attaining virtue and repelling temptations without living in the midst of society. The Holy Book of Quran vividly says, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. Allah tasks not a soul beyond its scope." Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 286. And again, in another verse, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Yuridu Allah bikumul yusr wa la yuridu bikumul usr." Allah desires for you ease. He desires not hardship for you. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 185. It is needless to add that there is no restriction on the place of worship in Islam. To have a clear concept of Islam, one should know that what it exactly means to be practical and not just talk about good deeds and having intention and so on. Okay, well, dear listeners, it seems that we ran out of time for this episode of Lantern. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode, and until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن. from Beirut.
Welcome to today's episode, broadcasting from the heart of Beirut, and I'm your host, Farah Atwe. The Israeli government's recent decision to advance settlement expansion in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights has sparked widespread condemnation across the region and beyond. But yet, nothing stopped it from moving forward. Announced on Sunday, the plan cites the war and the new front facing Syria as key factors, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu emphasizing that strengthening the Golan is strengthening the state of Israel. In response, several Middle Eastern countries, including Yemen, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Iraq, have condemned Israeli's actions. The expansion has also broader regional implications, particularly for Lebanon, as Israeli forces are now reportedly just 15 kilometers from the Damascus-Beirut International Highway, raising major concerns over the security dynamics in the region. I'm joined by Mr. Ali Rizik, a political and security analyst. Hello and welcome to this episode, Mr. Ali. As we highlighted, the Israeli government announced, and this is the latest announcement, that it wants to advance settlements expansion in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. What is allowing Israel to move in this very fast-paced, though a lot of criticism are coming towards it, but nothing is stopping it from expanding the settlements, from expanding the invasion, from taking over territories that is not theirs?
Obviously, Israel took advantage of the latest developments in Syria. We saw since day one of the departure of former President Bashar al-Assad, we saw the escalation. Even before that, by the way, the Israelis were escalating against Syria. So they're taking advantage to the maximum of these events. We know that the current Israeli government is an ideological fascist government which has its own expansionist agenda. So it's not very surprising, I believe, to see this activity taking place. Syria now is a weak state. Indeed, you could call it possibly a failed state. And that allows the Israelis, I think, to do as they wish when it comes to their expansionist agenda.
For the greater Israel?
It's part of it, of course, the greater Israel. Netanyahu, before during the latest developments, before the start of the war on Syria, but it was during the escalation on Lebanon when he spoke about a greater Middle East.
Yes.
And so I think this is all part of it, part of the broader Israeli agenda now. It doesn't necessarily serve Israeli interests. I think that's a different question. It might serve Netanyahu's ambitions by right now, but it doesn't necessarily serve Israeli interests, because Syria under a new leadership might be not allied with Iran like we saw before. And I think that if there were to emerge a Syrian country not under the leadership of Assad, but under the leadership of another party which is pro-Israeli, that I think would be more to Israel's benefit than having a weak state like you have now. So it's not necessarily the case that the Israelis are behaving in a way which serves their own interests. Mm-hmm.
But the impression that we're actually receiving as if is Syria is the central point for the ambition of creating or changing the face of the Middle East, as if it's very vital strategically, geographically. Israel is putting so much attention in there. Do you believe that that's the center point or the center power that will allow Israel to create or to change the face of the Middle East, starting from that strategic point?
Well, obviously, look, there's no denying the fact that Syria is a very important part of the axis of resistance. It's known as the linchpin of the axis of resistance. It connects Iran to Lebanon, Hezbollah. We all know that Hezbollah is Iran's number one strategic ally and Iran's number one ideological ally. Mm-hmm. So I think you can understand, based upon that, why the Israelis are giving so much importance to taking control, to seizing more and more territory. But I think, again, some of the behavior we're seeing is not necessarily strategic. Some of it is more ideological driven.
Yes.
And I think that doesn't bode very well for Israeli strategic considerations.
Okay. The Golan Heights is a Syrian territory, and it was occupied